Imagine the scene in a school playground. It's the end of the day, and lots of children are milling round, waiting for their parents to pick them up. Gradually, the children move off as their parents arrive. But there's one little boy who suddenly realises that he can't see anybody he knows. And his face turns from happiness to sadness and panic and tears as he calls out, "Daddy, Daddy!" But then his father arrives and calls out for his son, who rushes to him in great relief. Now, suppose the situation is different. Suppose it's Rwanda in 1994, a country torn by warfare and mass murder, when 800,000 people were massacred, when two people groups, the Hutus and Tutsis, turned on each other, and as much as 20% of the country's population died in the slaughter. And you were a little boy playing in a Rwandan village, and suddenly you hear screams and running, and you turn to look for a friendly face, but all you can see is angry shouting men running towards you with machetes. You run as fast as you can, and you hide under a basket that your mother wove. And when you come out, everyone is gone or dead. Your mother is dead. Your father is dead. Your brothers and sisters are dead. You sob yourself to sleep on the body of your mother as the sun goes down. And you wake up to realise that not only are you terrified that the enemy might come back, but that you're very hungry and thirsty. And it hits you that there's no one to take care of you or save you from your enemies or the wild animals or sickness. You're utterly alone. You find some bananas in a house and eat them. And another day passes. You don't have any idea what to do. And you begin to think that you will just die. But then you hear a sound and turn to see a tall man standing in the square. He calls out to you in his own language and says, "Don't be afraid, I want to help you." You want to run, but there's no place to run to, and nobody to run to. He comes over to you and pulls some bread out of his pouch and gives you some. And then he gives you some water from his water skin. He says, "I tried to stop them." And you notice the lacerations on his arms and head. He says, "If you come with me, I'll take care of you. I'm really sorry about your father and mother. I'll help you bury them." And as you work together to bury the dead, you begin to talk to him. And you learn that he belongs to the tribe that slaughtered your village and family. You also learn that he and his little son were in the tribal meeting when the band decided to raid your village. They disagreed with the raid and put themselves between their fellow kinsmen and your village. And as a result, the band of raiders killed the man's son as he tried to protect your village. And suddenly you feel an overwhelming sense that this man loves you. It cost him his son to try and save you. Not only that, it gradually comes out that this village has made horrible raids on his relatives in the past. And your own father was an arch enemy of this very man and had tried several times to kill him. At first, this makes you very afraid. But then you realise that this man is trying to save you in spite of this animosity between your tribes and families. And your sense of being loved becomes stronger. Hope starts to rise in your broken heart that maybe there would be love beyond the loss of your mother and father and brothers and sisters. So you agree to go with the man. And over the next several months, you learn the almost unbelievable truth that this man has had a university education from Oxford, that he's a very wealthy businessman with homes in Burundi and London, and a farm in Yorkshire. You don't understand it, but over time, you learn that not only has he rescued you from death, but he's supplying all your needs beyond what you could have imagined. He takes you into his home in Burundi, and you take long holidays with him in London and the sheep farm. And with every new lavish gift, you feel more and more loved. He rescued you. It cost him his son's life in the process. You were part of a tribe that hated him and his father. And now, as the years go by, you start to understand, on top of all this, he's taken care of all the affairs for you to be his legal son. And you learn that he's signed over to you all his wealth as an inheritance. What amazing, generous love. Now, I believe that that's the kind of thinking that lay behind John's words in 1 John 3, verse 1. See how great is the love the Father has lavished upon us, that we should be called children of God. And that is what we are. John wants us to see what a tremendous privilege it is to be a child of God. And we're going to see that he thinks we don't reflect on that or think about that or ponder it half enough. So why does he think it's so wonderful? Why does he say we should think and dwell on it more and more? Well, says John, for one thing, it cost God his son to save us from sin and death and hell. In verse 16 of 1 John 3, he says that. This is how we know what love is, that he laid down his life for us. Or perhaps in the very well-known John 3, verse 16. For God so loved us, so loved the world, that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. And the Apostle Paul, in the first reading we had in Romans, helps us even more to understand this. He describes, first of all, how God saw us when he found us. So in Romans chapter 5, look at verses 6, 8 and 10, which I think is going to go up on the screen. So in verse 6, Paul says, you see, at just the right time, when we were powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Then verse 8, God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And then verse 10, for if while we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to him through the death of his son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through his life? Can you see the three phrases in those verses that describe us? When we were still powerless, without strength, when we were helpless, when we were totally unable to make any contribution to the salvation we desperately needed, when there wasn't a thing we could do about it, we were utterly bankrupt, and even our good was tainted with self-interest, so that we could make no contribution whatsoever. When we were without strength, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly, for us. But it doesn't stop there, does it, in that passage? It goes on even further. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Still sinners, proud, overbearing in our attitude with God, maybe treating him with condescension and indifference, because that's what sin does. It makes us tiresome individuals, difficult to live with, hard to get along with. But when we were like that, then Christ died for us. But even that doesn't exhaust the description, because Paul goes on a verse or two later to say, if we were enemies, or while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son. While we were enemies, not only without strength, not only sinners, proud in our attitude, but also when we were absolutely opposed to God, when we were actually enemies of his grace, hateful, resenting what God was doing, and resisting his every attempt he made to reach us. That's Paul's description. And so, says John, don't you think that's amazing love? As one writer put it, God flings the blood-stained mantle of his love over us and calls us his children. He not only calls us this, but he actually makes us like this. See the end of verse 1 of 1 John 3? We are children of God. And start of verse 2, dear friends, now we are children of God. Not only were we enemies who didn't want anything to do with God, to whom God said, I want something to do with you, but he went way beyond the love of rescue and the love of sacrifice and the love of compassion and leniency to his enemies. He showed us another kind of love, a love beyond all that. He took us into his family. He made us to be called children of God. I think it's all too easy for Christians to take that for granted. We might even think that it's actually God's job to love us, because that's what he did, isn't it? That's what he is, isn't it? That's what his actions are. That's what he does. Because he did create the world, didn't he? So why shouldn't he love his world and the people in it? And in any case, why shouldn't I be a child of God like anyone else? If God is love, as the Bible says, why shouldn't he love me? If you're a Christian here this evening, does the love of God amaze you? Does it astonish you? Maybe we shouldn't take God's love for granted. Sometimes familiarity can breed contempt, especially if perhaps we've been Christians for many years. Maybe we need to realise that he might not have saved us at all. He might have said, enemies don't need saving. They certainly don't deserve saving, and that's that. He might have said, my son is too precious to pay for humans, let alone ungodly, rebellious humans. But he might also have said, I will save them from hell and forgive their sins and give them an eternal existence on another planet. And I'll communicate with them through my messengers, through my angels. Nothing in us or in the nature of the world required that God would go beyond all redeeming, forgiving, rescuing, healing love to this extreme, namely an adopting love. A love that won't settle for a truce or formal gratitude, but will press in all the way to make you and me a child of God, a member of his family. A little boy was once being teased at school because he was adopted. He put up with the jibes of his classmates patiently for a while, and then he blurted out in self-defense, you can say what you like. All I know is that my parents chose me. Yours couldn't help having you. And of course, he was right. Understood that way, adoption's not a disgrace, it's a privilege. In a world filled with unhappy and unwanted children, this adopted child knew he was no unfortunate intrusion into the life of his mother and father. They had a free choice, and they elected to call him their son. Well, if that's true of those adopted by human parents, how much more true is it of Christians who have been called the children of God? We've been adopted into the family of the living God. We've got millions of brothers and sisters all over the world. God has come to us, and he's brought us into his family. And that was motivated by pure love. Love that's at the very centre of God's being. Adoption is a legal action by which a person takes into their family a child who's not their own, who has no rights within that family, in order to give that child all the privileges of their own children. An adopted child, according to the law of the land, is entitled to all the rights and privileges of a natural-born child. What motivates someone to do that? Perhaps at considerable cost to themselves. Well, there's all sorts of reasons for doing so. It might be a longing for children by someone who's unable to have any. It might be pity towards those children who have no family. It might be something about a particular child that adoptive parents are attracted to. It might be out of friendship towards that adopted child's parents who have died. There's all sorts of reasons. But then we have to ask, what was it that made God adopt us? And the answer is pure love. For there was nothing appealing in us that he should be attracted to us. In fact, the opposite's the case. Naturally, we're repulsive to God because of our sin. He couldn't look at us and think, ah, there's someone who deserves to be adopted, and therefore we drew his love from him. No. The truth is that we're his children, adopted into his family, because of his sheer, undeserved love for us. But even that's not an adequate description of this kind of love. John is not just thinking in terms of adoption. He's thinking in terms of something even more profound. He's thinking in terms of new birth. There's no human analogy to that. If I find a child and want to take him into my home, I can't cause that child to be born again. I take that child and I love that child with the personality and temperament that the child has from his biological parents. I may try and influence that child with love, but I don't get into the very nature of the person and change it. But God does. The love that God has in view here in 1 John 3 verse 1 is not the type of love that merely takes care of the paperwork and adopts. That would be amazing beyond words, to be adopted into God's family. But John says that God doesn't just adopt, he moves in by his spirit, his seed, John calls it, and imparts something of himself to us so that we can begin to take on a family resemblance. Verse 9 of 1 John 3 puts it like this. No one who is born of God practices sin, because his seed abides in him, and he cannot go on practicing sin because he's born of God. By this we know the children of God. If you're a child of God here this evening, you are so by adoption, yes, but by more than adoption, by new birth. 1 John 5 verse 1 says it this way. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ has been born of God. And whoever loves the Father loves the child born of him. So the love of God goes beyond the story of that wealthy businessman who took care of all the legal matters to adopt that orphan from Rwanda. God does not stop in his pursuit of closeness and communion until he's penetrated our very souls and planted his seed within us and given us a new nature, a nature like God's, in the image of God. So God has brought us into his family through adoption. The Apostle Paul puts it like this in Ephesians 1. He in love predestined us for adoption to sonship through Jesus Christ in accordance with his pleasure and will. But more than adoption, he predestined us to be conformed to the image of his Son. That is, he caused us to be born again. He made us new creatures in Christ. He put his spirit within us and began that transforming work from inside that would shape us into the family likeness of God. He wanted us in the family. He wanted us to be at home. So he went beyond adoption and gave us a second birth. So what amazing love God has for all who put their trust in him. Let's be thankful for it and not take it for granted. And ask God to make it fresh and real for us. Because I think John is aware that we can lose our sense of delight and gratitude for God's love. And John says, I'm writing this to you because I want you to be stunned in a new way at God's amazing grace and love. And we can see that from the very first word he uses in chapter 3 and verse 1. It's sometimes not translated in certain English versions, but it is there in the original. If you had the old NIV, which was published in 1984, for some reason they miss out the first word. But I gather you all use the new NIV, which was published in 2011, which has put it back in. And quite right, because it's there in the original. But perhaps for the older members of our congregation, we should go back to the Authorised Version, the King James Version, because that had it there. And you've got it on the bottom of your sheet, the King James Version, the Authorised Version. Behold, what manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us, that we should be called the children of God. Behold, see, as if John is saying, I want to create an atmosphere of astonishment and explanation. Behold, what extraordinary love. What an astonishing thing. So how can I realise afresh how amazing this love is? Behold, stop, look, listen. Something significant is coming. As I say, the old NIV, just how great is the love? That's not strong enough. If you want to appreciate just how great this love is, don't pass over it. Don't move on from it. Don't go to verse 2 too quickly, says John. Stop, look, listen, reflect on it. Take time to appreciate it anew. Don't rush away from it. Just because you may have been a Christian a long time, that doesn't mean that you should not appreciate afresh and be renewed and amazed by this love of God. Behold, what extraordinary love. What type of love is this? What kind of love is this? The word suggests something exotic and mysterious, something that comes from a distant country. Cinderella had the help of her fairy godmother to make her beautiful. But our prince saw us in rags and still loved us. Do we really appreciate the wonder of that? We often sing hymns and songs as we have tonight. Do you know Amazing Grace? How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. But has it dawned on you how amazing that grace is, that we should be called children of God? I think we overdo the use of the word amazing. Do you use the word amazing? That was an amazing cake. That was an amazing film. On Wednesday night, I said, Spurs scored an amazing goal. I looked it up in the dictionary. Amazing. To affect with great wonder, causing wonder or astonishment. John says, that's what God's love is like. That's how amazing it is. And John says, I want you to grasp how different from all other kinds of love God's love really is. Behold, see, it's a command at the beginning of the verse. Because John says, I want to draw your attention to this amazing love. See it, dwell on it. Let the truth sink in. Take time and ponder God's love for us. Gareth would tell us that literally the Greek is, what manner is this? What country does this love come from? It's as if the Father's love is so unearthly, so foreign to this world, that John wonders what country it may come from. What foreign land is this that's represented in love like that? It's so different, it's so strange. God has shown such love to us. And John said he's not merely shown it to us, he's lavished it upon us. It's a fact. We are children of God. And so John says, stop and reflect on this love. allow the reality of it to sink into the depths of our being. Because John says this amazing love is meant to take our breath away. It's meant to startle us. It's meant to amaze us. It's meant to leave us gasping at the love which God has for his children. A love in which God takes the initiative to make us his children. A love that gives lavishly and freely to those who are utterly undeserving. And God's love for sinners like us is such that it delights to change us into children of God. And John is so amazed by this wonderful truth that he says at the end of verse 1, that's what we are now. That's what we are. It's not some wishful thinking. It's not some abstract theological truth. It's an eternal reality. We are now children of God in this wicked world. So why is it that sometimes some Christians find it difficult to accept God's love for them? The fact it's unconditional and limitless. And it's the sort of love we can never experience to the same extent in any human relationship. I think there's some Christians who've only known in their lives conditional love, restrictive love, love that's based on what we do and how we respond. And some people who are like that don't always find it easy to accept God's perfect love. They tend to feel that we've got to do something to deserve that love, to earn that love, because maybe that's how it was for them as a child. They feel that they have to meet certain expectations before they know love. A student once passed his exam successfully, and he rang his father to tell him his results. And his father's response shocked him a little, for he said, "Good, that means we can still remain friends." Well, that's conditional love. But sometimes that sort of attitude cuts into our thoughts and emotions, so that for some people, it's simply hard to accept that God loves them unconditionally, full stop. What happens when we don't accept God's unconditional love for us? Perhaps we try to impress God with our lives so that we can feel in some way we're earning his love. Perhaps we can embark on lots of Christian activity to try to prove to ourselves and to God that we deserve his love. But actually, that sort of thinking perverts the love of God, and it turns God's grace into a religion of works. But God's love and grace are not dependent on whether we reach a certain standard that pleases him. He loves us because he loves us. He lavishes his love upon us day after day, week after week, no matter how we've been living before him. When we've fallen into sin, he doesn't love us any less as a result. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that God doesn't demand anything of us, or that he's not grieved when we fall into sin, or is not concerned about our weakness or apathy. But his love for us is so great that he deals with us when we sin, that he constantly reminds us of our Christian duties, and he works in us when we become apathetic. But he does all of this and much more because he loves us. God will never love us any less or any more than he loves you at this moment of time. He won't love us more in heaven when we're perfect than he loves us now. His love is unconditional. And it's so important that we learn this lesson. Otherwise, we might be tempted to serve him in order to impress him or perhaps impress others, rather than serving him because we love him in response to his love for us. So John says it's good to stop from time to time. It's good to assess our lives honestly before God and perhaps ask ourselves how much we do to impress God or perhaps others. Or is our Christian activity a response to this amazing love the Father has for us as his children? Our security comes to an understanding of our Father's love for us in Jesus Christ. Our identity as the children of God doesn't depend on our activity, but on his sovereign love for us. So let's this evening take John's advice. Let's be assured of God's unconditional, sacrificial, and unending love for us. And let's keep reflecting on it. Behold, see this wonderful love. You've got on your sheet a quotation from someone called Rico Tice. Rico Tice works at a church in London called All Souls, Langham Place, and he's the one who wrote the Christianity Explored course. And this is what he said once. Every morning when I wake up, God is delighted with me. And God is delighted with me, not because of anything I've done, but because God delights in Jesus, and I've put my trust in Jesus. What joy! It's easy to labour under the impression sometimes that if I do just slightly more, God will be more pleased with me. So untrue. So how do we experience God's love? Sometimes he comes to us by his Spirit and gives us a fresh impression of that love. And that's why John tells us in chapter 3, verse 1, to stop, to behold and see. Sometimes I think God reminds us of his love through singing songs about that love. We've sung them tonight. We're going to end with a song like that. But on the reverse of your sheet, I've printed out two songs, fairly recent songs, about God's love. So I just want to invite you to take the words of those songs home with you tonight. If you know the songs, sing them. But even if you don't know the songs, just look at the words, focusing on what kind of love is this. So how are you this evening? Have you been a Christian long? Perhaps many years. Perhaps you've only been a Christian a short time. What do you think of the love of God? Do you take it for granted? Are you a bit bored with Gareth going on every week thanking God for his love and his Jesus' death? Why can't he turn the record over and say something a bit different? So why does he do that? Because it's so precious. Because it's the absolute fundamental basis for the Christian faith. And that's why John says, don't stop thinking about it. Don't pass over it, take it for granted. Don't even think it's God's job to do that, because it's not. God's love is unconditional. It's free. And it flows to all those who put their trust in him. Let's come to this God now and ask him to renew us, to refresh us, and help us to take away from here tonight a deep and abiding sense of his great undeserved love for us.